Welcome to MidEcon, a podcast that highlights work done by students and faculty in the Economics Department at Middlebury College. I'm Eric Gong, a professor in the department, and I'll be your host for this episode. My guest for this episode is Ted Chambers. Ted is class of 2025, and his work is at the intersection of public health and urban planning. And he's done a fascinating thesis that looks at a movement called Vision Zero. It started in Europe and has since spread to multiple cities in the United States. The premise is simple. How can we redesign cities to be more pedestrian friendly? And if you live in one of these cities, you might already have been seeing these changes. Streets closed off to traffic and more people walking around. In Ted's thesis, he investigates if Vision Zero is leading to fewer traffic deaths. Ted has been fun to advise. He's incredibly independent, thoughtful, and a careful thinker. I hope someday he ends up being an urban planner in a large city. I think he has a lot to offer. And I hope you enjoy my talk with Ted. Ted, welcome to the program. I'm so glad you're able to stop by.
Yeah, great to be here.
Well, I'm really excited to hear more about your thesis. Now, obviously, I know about your thesis as I'm your advisor, but I really love how students are able to tell their story and kind of give us some details behind the scenes, but also just being able to articulate their thesis. So thanks again for stopping by. Before we begin, I would love to actually get maybe a little background on you. How did you actually end up at Middlebury?
Yeah, so I think being a senior in high school, I went to a smaller high school. There were only 100 kids in my graduating class, and I realized that I liked a smaller setting, so it's kind of small liberal arts colleges, and Middlebury really stood out to me as like one of my top picks, especially kind of in the NESCACs. And what I was really looking for was a place where I could really make good connections in a small setting, preferably in a rural setting, and Middlebury just really checked a lot of boxes for me, and you know, I've loved it so far. I think it was one of the better choices I made in my life.
So you ruled out big cities, universities.
While my mom went to Indiana University, I went to IU to visit, and just it was kind of like a gut thing. I said, this is not for me. So,
Wow. Now, let me see. You're just an econ major, is that correct?
I'm an econ history double major.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You know, there are a lot of econ history, either double majors or minors, who I've been supervising this past semester. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of interplay between the two subjects. And at the same, like the way I think about it is history is maybe the more qualitative side of economics, and economics is more of the quantitative side of history. And economics kind of propel the events I study in history, and some of the history propels some of the economic events. So it's a good mix of both quantitative study and qualitative studying. And I'm glad that I go to a school like Middlebury where I can pursue both.
Yeah, that's great. We are very fortunate to have you as an econ major. Do you think, thinking back upon your first year here, has your impression of the econ major or economics in general, has that changed since you've been here?
I think it definitely has. I think I discovered I loved economics maybe this year. And I think that maybe...
Wait, so it took you 4 years.
It took me 4 years. But I think for a lot of the time, it was just a lot of, okay, this is something I get. This is something I definitely works worth studying. And that's something I'm really like interested in. But it was just a lot of like kind of theoretical graphs. So like, supply, demand, whatever, Phillips curve. And I was like, this doesn't seem applicable to me. And I'm like, this is just like really heavy theory. And I took causal inference, which is a class that any economics major at Middlebury should take.
So this is Econ 311.
Yeah, Econ 311. And that's when it kind of clicked. The economics is just not all this kind of very drab academic, like kind of theory, but this is an actually really applicable subject field where you can do anything. And it's not just monetary policy. It's not just kind of dealing with money. It's dealing with how people interact with the world and how people, it's a social science. And I think that's something that I wish I kind of was exposed to a little bit earlier, but I'm really glad that I kind of figured that out maybe a little bit too late, but
having a light bulb moment, while we all wish we had these moments earlier in life, it's great that you had one. Not everyone gets that opportunity to all of a sudden say, oh, this all makes sense.
And at the end of the day, like, I'm glad I wasn't overly daunted, and I'm glad that I, you know, worked hard, stuck it out. And I'm not saying that I totally hated my intro classes, but it was a lot of, why am I doing this? And I finally got, especially at this experience, this is why I was doing it. And, you know, that kind of upfront work is 100% worth it.
Yeah. And so for those who don't know, you're talking very fondly about Econ 311, which is causal inference. But the two classes that come before that, there's the statistics class, Econ 111, and then there's linear regression, Econ 211. So it sounds like 311 follows after 211.
Yes. Yeah. And so I would explain my experience with Econ stats was, I think, because of my own fault, not the best one, and kind of first time, basically since before COVID, taking a heavily empirical kind of quantitative class. And so that was kind of maybe soured my perception of it. But then regression, I took with Professor Biker, and she kind of started to bring in what I was talking about 311. And that's when I'm like, okay, I need to take 311, because I feel like I've only scratched the surface of what's possible with this major.
Yeah. I guess another way of thinking about it is that Econ 311 basically says, you can almost ask any question in social science, and we will give you the tools to help you use data to answer that question.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think at the end of the day, economics is more, what I kind of realized maybe towards the end again, is econ is using social science with data to solve questions. While, you know, maybe some other disciplines, some other social sciences are maybe a little less math heavy. But what's great about that econ is you have more kind of oomph to your argument. You have more evidence to rely on. You have more like believable to the general public, and like less theoretical. And that's kind of something that I also love about it, that you can say, oh, well, here's this, you know, proven equation that proves that I'm right. While maybe with some other disciplines, you're kind of stuck with having all these assumptions and stuff. So it's another thing I like.
And I guess we would also say that a lot of the things that you learned early on in those intro courses, they do come into play later on, even though it might not be so obvious when you're doing it.
Yeah, 110%. And I like, even with this thesis right now, I'm relying back to some concepts that, you know, I filed away somewhere freshman year in between, you know, trying to figure out Middlebury and everything. So it's kind of good to see that continuity.
Yeah. For students who are maybe in their first or second year at Middlebury, who are considering the econ major, do you have any advice to give to these students? Like, what type of student would like do really well in the major?
It's somebody who's analytical, somebody who's curious, and somebody who's willing to be challenged. I think there's a lot of, sometimes there's a sense that econ's a major you can kind of like grunt out, and you can take that course, but that's not worth your time, in my opinion. I think you need to be curious, and you think you need to challenge yourself. You should take 311. You should, you know, really dive into like the academic part of the subject and not just click the boxes on stats and click the boxes on regression, but really get into what I'm talking about and get into the analytical problem solving side of the major, because that's where you're going to find, in my opinion, like the most utility.
That's great. So let's talk about your thesis, which is something that you've really invested a lot of time and effort in over the past several months. Your thesis is titled Infrastructure Change and Public Health Outcomes, Vision Zero and Pedestrian Fatalities. What is your thesis all about?
Yeah, so I think elevator pitch of the thesis is that there's this big problem in America. One of the leading causes of death is motor vehicle related fatalities. It's, I think, number three. It's an expensive problem, costs a lot of money for the nation. And the way that America is set up, it's very unique. We're one of the few countries in the world. We are automobile centric, which means that people use their car as their primary mode of transportation, other than, they say, a subway, a bike, walking, a train. And this is a public health and a public policy like conundrum. This is something that America is going to have to face. And, you know, we had in the 70s, we had this little shock with the oil embargo, realizing that our mode of transportation was not sustainable. I think we're having that again in the modern day. And it's something that we need to address. And one of the people who are addressing this is the Vision Zero organization. They're a public policy organization who advocate for infrastructure, real infrastructure change in American cities to address this automobile-centric design. And with the goal of limiting pedestrian fatalities to zero, e.g. Vision Zero, e.g. their name. Mm-hmm. And basically just finding out, like, does this policy even work? Is it worthwhile? It's a costly policy. And, like, this is something I think is going to become bigger and bigger and is increasingly becoming bigger. If you live in, you know, a mid to larger size cities, you're starting to see bike lanes in your cities. You're starting to see wider sidewalks. You maybe are going to see that there's a light rail line going on. For example, Los Angeles is constructing one right now for the Olympics. And so these are changes that are going to happen in our lifetime. I think it's something that I'm interested in studying.
Yeah. You know, I don't think a podcast does this topic justice, because you have to really see how these cities are transformed, right? When Vision Zero really takes root.
Yeah, I would say it's definitely more, I think also a great part about it is it's very interdisciplinary. My little brother is a geography major, and he came to my symposium. He came up after me and said, "Okay, good work, Ted. You had a great geography thesis." And I said, "Well, geography majors wouldn't be doing the same calculations that I'm doing." But it's a very visual, like, place and time heavy thesis. So it's not a lot of other people for the thesis will do implementing a policy or implementing some government change or maybe something like this. But mine, I think, is very based in geographical and based in the physical. And that is kind of hard articulating both through work, through text, and through voice. But, you know, just maybe if you listen to this podcast, you'll start to look around and start to see these changes, because they're coming, but they're coming very slowly. They're coming very gradually. And that's, like, something that you should be aware of.
Yeah. So if you're listening to this, but you want to kind of actually see what happens when Vision Zero changes a city's landscape, is there, like, a city that stands out to you that they can Google and, you know, type in Vision Zero and see those changes?
Yeah, I think a really great one. So in America, I think New York City is one of the leaders. And in my thesis, I go into looking at New York and looking at kind of changes in the city. But probably the one that is kind of the worldwide example right now is Paris, France. So they notably are changing the majority of their downtown to be public transport, bike centric. They're actually cars. It's very hard to drive around in Paris, but at the same time, it's super easy to take a bike, to take a subway, or just to walk somewhere. And it's actually, it's like, people in Paris are realizing that the cars are actually hindrance to their life in their city and not actually a piece of utility.
Yeah. So I guess we would encourage listeners to go on Google and search what, like, Paris Vision Zero before and after, see the striking changes.
Exactly. And I think a really good, another really good resource is a YouTube channel called Not Just Bikes. And they do a lot of other really good work on it. And a lot of, like Professor Dahl was talking about, a lot of really good visualizations.
Yeah, that's great. What inspired this question? It's really fascinating, but I always love to hear people's personal stories on how they got to their question.
Yeah, I think so. I think what really inspired this question was my, like, kind of own experience growing up. So I grew up in what's called a streetcar suburb in Niagara Falls, New York. There is no more streetcars in Niagara Falls, New York, but it is a very dense urban space with mixed use development and the opportunities to take modes of transit that are not only a car to get to your destination. So I grew up walking to school. I grew up walking or biking to my friend's house, biking to the convenience store, etc. And so kind of that experience combined with I spent some time abroad in the Netherlands, who are also are big forerunners in this movement. And it kind of made me realize that my experience is very unique. And the majority of experience kind of in America is based around a car and based around this kind of mode of transportation. But that has implications that might not be the best for society, the best for public health. And so looking at it and looking at all these experiences kind of made me interested in how we interact with our built environment and maybe how we can change it.
Yeah. It sounds like that kind of the history bent of you really had to dive into the context and different laws and the history behind Vision Zero. But there's also the kind of the data component. Can you, I don't know, give us a summary. Where did you find the data? Was it a difficult process for you?
Yeah, I would describe my data experience as highly arduous. I would like to quickly shout out the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. They publish a really good data set that tracks every single fatality by car in America, which I'm blessed to have. But they only let you download it city by city. So lots of loops, lots of downloads, kind of a lot of grunt data scraping, but you know, that's part of the job. And also probably compared to a lot of people who, you know, do these very impressive economic works, my data experience was probably not as hard as theirs. So I just would like to put that out there.
Yeah, I think it's very, I thought it was very challenging. So to my understanding, what you're doing in your thesis is you're comparing cities who sort of implemented Vision Zero to what we would call control cities, cities that don't. And you're going to just look at things like pedestrian fatalities over time to see if there's a change. Is that kind of the gist of it?
That's a really good way to put it. I'm also looking at some other things like the GDP of the city, the unemployment rate in the city, and the ozone rate in the city, just to kind of dive a little bit deeper into these other arguments surrounding Vision Zero.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think everyone is in a state of suspense. What are the main results?
Yeah, I think the main result, because I'm talking about the main outcome variable, is that cities that enact Vision Zero compared to cities that do not enact Vision Zero see a decrease between 0.5 and 0.66 per 100,000 in pedestrian fatalities. Now, that does not sound like that much. That is basically half a person in 100,000. So, you know, but when you actually quantify that in terms of monetary gain using something called the statistic value of life, which is a measure of the value of a person's life from an insurance angle, cities are going to save $6.6 to $8.7 million if they implement this change. And this change is as little as $100,000 per mile of infrastructure change. So theoretically, a city could put in 66 miles of this change and have a net zero output. So I would say that this is really a worthwhile change to undertake. And even half a person is worth, like, say, because you're talking about human lives.
Right, right. And maybe to put it also in a kind of additional context, that's per 100,000. So let's say I have a city of like 1 million people. Your research would suggest that for 1 million people, you would save like, you know, 5 to 6 lives.
Yeah, yes. And that's meaningful. And capturing that magnitude is definitely very important.
Yeah. And if we scale that up to say like, I don't know, New York or Los Angeles, these are big cities,
yeah,
5 or 6 million.
Yeah.
So those are meaningful numbers.
Those are definitely meaningful numbers, especially with like this public health crisis.
So it sounds like, okay, maybe I'm a city planner. Let's implement Vision Zero because I'm going to save lives. Are there any costs to consider? I can imagine a critic of this program would say, well, if you're going to, you know, have more bike lanes and close down car traffic to the heart of my city, that's going to result in a lot of businesses getting impacted. Do you have any thoughts, either based on your findings, on like the effects on economic activity?
Yeah, I can talk on both my findings and my personal thoughts. So my findings kind of point to a kind of, I would say, mixed bag from implementing. So against conventional wisdom, both GDP and unemployment are forecasted to increase using my model. And I think that's just due to the control cities kind of being elite coastal cities that maybe have more knowledge workers and less labor intensive industries. And so I think that's pointing to broader economic patterns and not this policy. And in terms of like more of the theoretical, the counter argument is that a car can hold usually like this, the standard amount of every car ride of the car that holds is about 1.5 person. A bus or a subway can hold a way larger magnitude of that. And if we're transporting people and making kind of promenades downtown, more walkable environments downtown, that's going to organically increase foot traffic. So people who go to these shops will go in there kind of on a whim and not because they drove into the city center in their car just because they wanted to buy a suit. But somebody who walks down the street to get to the suit shop might pass a florist and say, oh, I also want to buy flowers. So I think it's going to generate actually more economic activity from making these changes.
Oh, wow, that's great. Now, let's say I'm a second or third year student listening to this and I'm thinking about doing a thesis. Any advice for someone who is considering doing a senior thesis?
I'd say just be very curious, be open to your research question maybe not working out, and have like a lot of research questions. Kind of talking with some of my friends and like my thesis group, which is me and three other very talented people who are also doing theses. Like, it's a hard process and you need to be ready to fail. You need to be ready to accept results that you might not like. For a while, I had results that kind of went against my thesis, and I like went back into the data and realized I was actually messing up. So I say just be open to criticism, be open to failure, and you'll be very successful.
That's great advice. All right. Well, we are now down to our last four questions that we like to ask our guests. The first is, what is your favorite thing about Middlebury?
It's a little cliche answer, but definitely the people. I think everybody here is very collegiate, very curious, and like very friendly at the end of the day, and very respectful of one another. And I think that's, you know, all you can ask about people. And I'm glad that I'm going to a school that people have those values.
We're glad that you're here as well. How about this? What would you tell your 16-year-old self?
To be less serious. You're still a kid. You have more than enough opportunities to be serious later in life.
Were you a very serious 16-year-old?
I think I was in like a moody teenager way. Like I thought too much about stuff and made opinions too early. I think, you know, maybe a better piece of advice would be to just look at things in the macro and, you know.
Yeah.
You're 16. Nothing's right. That deep.
Right. Where do you hope to be in 10 years?
I'm not quite sure. I think, I hope I'm happy. I hope, like I have a family who I love. And I think at the end of the day, I'm just fulfilled by what I do. And I'm seeing some success. I don't know how I'm going to define that success, but yeah.
All right. Our last question. And it's an easy one. Maybe. We'll see. What is the meaning or purpose of life?
I think there's like two main purposes. I think one is maybe more philosophical and one's maybe more biological. I think the first one is just to do good and leave the world a little bit better than you got it, which I hope everybody thinks that way. I think another one is just to like have a family and, you know, contribute. Like the biggest gift to this world is life. So I think that is also something that some maybe people are missing in this world, but I think it's very important.
What a wonderful way to end our conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Ted, I really appreciate it. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you for listening to Mid Econ. Please consider sharing this episode with family or friends who might have an interest in economics at Middlebury. And if you have a moment, please leave a review. Finally, if you have any questions, feel free to email me at egong@middlebury.edu. Subject line, Mid-Econ Podcast. Until next time, please stay curious about the world and kind to others around you.